out that rescued the industry. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports.
In an interview with the Detroit News, Mitt Romney accused the Obama administration of holding on to the government's stake in GM for political reasons. The former Massachusetts governor says the president is trying to avoid an embarrassing financial loss before the election. Romney says if elected, he'll sell the government stock quickly.
I think it would maximize the loss to the taxpayer if that was done right away.
Sean McAlinden is with the Center for Automotive Research. He says selling right now would mean a loss of billions. But
we probably could get certainly a better return on our investment, at least that part of it, in a year.
McAlinden says no one in the auto industry wants government involvement in GM to run in perpetuity. But he thinks the government should wait for the economy, especially in Europe, to pick up. Most auto analysts expect GM to grow more profitable with time. Meanwhile, executives at GM, like Greg Martin, are bracing for a long summer of being the political football.
We expect there's going to be a lot of political theater, a lot of rhetoric between now and November. This is par for the course during a high election season. We're not going to respond every time a charge is made one way or the other.
Martin says he'll leave politics to the politicians because making cars is hard enough. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
Last week here on the Afternoon Magazine, we told you about a rare spectacle that would appear in yesterday's sky. It was the planet Venus crawling across the face of the sun, appearing as a black spot. The transit of Venus, which won't happen again for more than 100 years, attracted more than 500 people to Champaign's Parkland College campus yesterday. They observed the transit through special eclipse glasses, telescopes, and pieces of paper projecting the sun's image. Illinois Public Media's Sean Powers spoke to spectators who came out to see the rare event. He has this audio postcard.
I'm Stuart Levy. I'm an amateur astronomer. I'm with the U of I Astronomy Club. I'd seen this 8 years ago at dawn, where the sun was rising with Venus already in transit, and now here it started.
You won't see it again forever.
Well, yeah, not in my 2117, I guess, is the next chance. The last time before 2004 that this happened, John Philip Sousa composed a transit of Venus march in its honor. It doesn't sound like it's suggesting a transit or anything like that. It's just a march, and it has a cool name. And he did it, you know, it suggests the interval between these events.
My name's Mike Rosenberger. I'm a farmer in southern Champaign County. Jupiter's really cool because you can actually watch the planet turn. If you watch it in the winter, you get 10 hours of viewing. It rotates once every 10 hours. And so you can actually see the whole surface of the planet if you stay out all night. You start looking in the heavens like that, and your minor little problems don't seem so big. You know, you look at the immensity of what's happening out there and what's happening here on Earth. It really helps a lot. It helps me a lot. This is an 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope, and you might want to even take a look, too, to help you describe what's going on.
I see a big, big red disk, glowing red, with a little black circle moving over it. And I can also see other little black dots that are sunspots. It's really great. It's so impressive, you know?
You seem really locked into it. What are you thinking about as you're looking at that?
I'm thinking about this is a once-in-a-lifetime thing, and I'm thinking about how amazing the heavens are. I mean, it just knocks me out. I'm Jan Heinle, and I'm a retired professor at the University of Illinois in the English department.
My name's Ken Chapman, and I work at the University of Illinois, focusing an image of the sun onto a paper plate. And I can see a small dot on the face of the sun, which is the shadow of Venus.
This is incredible. Are you going to look at it through a telescope?
Oh, I probably will when my arms get tired. You can actually see it now. You see the little dot?
Yep.
And it'd take like 6 hours for it to cross the surface of the sun, and that'd actually get a little boring after a while.
My name is George Francis. I don't think I'm going to be alive for the next one, not even remotely. So I thought we'd better come out. We didn't see it 4 years ago. came out here to see the transit of Venus and also the transit of all of our friends here. And when there's an opportunity like this, you don't miss it.
Spectators catching the transit of Venus yesterday on the Parkland College campus in Champaign. That story was produced by Illinois Public Media's Sean Powers. For a photo slideshow, visit will.illinois.edu. It's a subject that spawned countless stand-up comedy routines, the poor quality of airline food. From the tiny bags of pretzels or peanuts to the stale bread and uninspired sandwiches, airline food is usually pretty disappointing. But there's a reason for that. Turns out producing food that actually tastes great at cruising altitude is a bit of a challenge. As NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports, some airlines are hoping to meet that challenge and lure more passengers by showcasing new and hopefully improved cuisine.
Every month, managers at Alaska Airlines gather at their catering company's giant kitchen to taste and critique new menu items. 41-year-old Clifton Lyles is ready for them. He's the airline's corporate chef, responsible for creating lovely-to-look-at, wonderful-tasting food that can be served in a flying tube at 35,000 feet.
For me, it's really challenging. Coming from, you know, traditional, classically trained chef background, to come in an environment where I was going to have to make good leftovers was kind of ego-bruising at the beginning.
But that feeling didn't last long. Indeed, he likes pushing the envelope of what is possible on board.
It's basically kind of a competition. You know, I've got this opponent who's logistically challenging me with lack of flavor because I'm at altitude. I've got to reheat it so I can't cook it fresh. And for me, it's to kind of figure out, okay, what can I do to overcome each of those challenges?
So this is a brand new asparagus and wild Alaskan smoked salmon quiche.
Kirsten Robinette, a product manager at Alaska Airlines, takes a tiny piece of the first-class breakfast entree. She passes it around the giant table for others to sample. Over the next hour or so, the group will taste more than a dozen items. The first-class offerings are more elegant and served on a plate. The coach fare that passengers can buy comes in a foil tin. Most of the items sampled get a big thumbs up, but a few need changes. Airlines actually cook their food on the ground and then reheat it in flight. And Robinette has discovered that one of the chicken dishes is too big for the container used for reheating.
A lot of times the leg's not sticking up like that, but this, it's not going to fit in there unless you would mash it down. So I don't know. I don't know what we're going to do.
Logistical challenges like this pop up all the time. And says the airline's Lisa Lukow,
even flight attendants that come to our menu reviews have no idea the amount of thought that goes behind every little entree, from folding the cheese to how do you wrap something. All of those details have to be considered.
But perhaps the most vexing problem facing Chef Lyles and his team is this. At cruising altitude, you lose about 20% to 30% of your sense of taste.
Most people don't realize that, but it definitely shows itself when you're eating in an airline.
He explains that as the cabin is pressurized and the humidity inside the plane falls, some of your taste buds go numb, and your sense of smell is diminished too. Things that tasted great on the ground are now bland and boring.
I have to use your eyes, I have to use your nose, I have to use your ears, every other sense that I can involve in the meal itself in order to translate what it is that you're missing by your sense of taste is what makes it successful. If I was just to go by, okay, it's 20 to 30% less flavor, I'll add 20 to 30% more, it's not going to work.
Few people pick an airline for its culinary offerings. Indeed, one of the most popular and profitable airlines, Southwest, typically offers only peanuts and pretzels. Still, passengers say food is a part of the customer experience, and in a highly competitive environment, many airlines are trying to do whatever they can to get more people onto their planes. As for Chef Lyles, he has his own ambition. He wants to change the perception of airline food and wants people to stop wrinkling their noses when he tells them he's an airline chef. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
Join us in September for WILL's Civil War Train. Board vintage train cars for stops in Vicksburg, Atlanta, Kennesaw Mountain, Chickamauga, and New Orleans. Visit the Smithsonian Southern and Southeast Railway Museums and see Civil War-era Washington, D.C. The trip is nearly sold out. Call 217-333-7300 or visit www.will.illinois.edu/willtravel for more information.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 6th of June, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who said, "A writer is someone for whom writing is more difficult than it is for other people." Thomas Mann, born in Lübeck, Germany, 1875, author of Buddenbrooks, Mario and the Magician, Dr. Faustus. It's the birthday of the poet Maxine Kilman, born in Philadelphia, 1925. Took up writing poetry seriously when she was in her 30s, in the middle of her third pregnancy. She said, "The grit of discontent, the acute misery of early and uninformed motherhood worked under my skin to force out the writer." She's written many poems about her farm in New Hampshire, especially in the book Up Country, Poems of New England. Kilman said, "My poetry is pretty much centered in New England, but more poetry of people and animals than of landscape. I suppose it could be called pastoral, but not a romanticized pastoral. It has real manure in it and real rain and real anguish and loss, just as much as it has some of the sunny hours." It was on this day, 1949, George Orwell's novel 1984 was published, beginning with the line, "It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. He wrote most of the novel on the island of Jura in the Scottish Hebrides. It was raining most of the time. He kept on with the book even as he became more and more ill with tuberculosis and died in 1950, less than a year after the book was published. It's the birthday of Pushkin, Alexander Pushkin, born Moscow, 1799. Died at the age of 38, but in his brief life worked in nearly every literary form. His masterpiece was the verse novel Eugene Onegin, about a man who kills his friend in a duel. Pushkin died in a duel. He was married to Natalia Goncharova, the most beautiful woman in Russia. She had many admirers, and one of her suitors was so persistent that Pushkin finally challenged him to a duel and died of his wounds 2 days later. It was on this date, 1889, the great Seattle fire destroyed downtown Seattle, started in the basement of a cabinet shop on the corner of Front and Madison. A pot of glue was sitting on top of a stove. The glue caught fire. Over 18 hours, the blaze wiped out the downtown district and the waterfront. And a year later, Seattle had nearly been rebuilt. All the construction